If people are uncompromising and can't broker a peaceful solution, a child 9 may feel angry, but their anger is usually overlooked or ignored. So they either keep it to themselves, mentally check out, or hightail it out of the room. Often, when my son Aiden and daughter Kaylee got into a fight in the car, Maddie would put her head against the window and fall asleep to escape the conflict. These little beauties feel like their ideas and feelings aren't valued, so they learn the art of merging very early in life. While they would prefer not being the center of attention for too much or too long, they long for us to notice and honor their presence. Like all kids, they're looking for a place and a way to feel like they belong. 9s in relationships. Mature 9s make wonderful partners, parents, and friends. Loyal and kind, they will go above and beyond the call of duty to support you. They're fun, flexible, and don't complain much. They love life's simple pleasures. If you give them the choice between getting dressed up and going to a black tie gala, or snuggling on the couch with you and the kids for pizza and a movie, they'll always pick the latter. 9s always have their special place in the home where they can retreat to be quiet and engage in an activity that enhances their experience of peacefulness. A healthy 9 is someone who has woken up and found their voice or come into their own. They know they're important enough to invest in and that they matter in the lives of their family, friends, and coworkers. A healthy 9 is spiritually inspiring. They're receptive to the world, yet not so open or lacking in boundaries that they lose their sense of self-definition. 9s who are asleep get in trouble in relationships when conflict arises and they refuse to acknowledge and resolve it. Denial is a big defense mechanism for them. They don't want to face anything that will unsettle their harmony, so they tell their inner orchestra to play louder while their ship is sinking. They might ignore the obvious signs that something's wrong, minimize the problems, or suggest a simple repair that only reveals how out of touch they are with the magnitude of the issue and how determined they are to avoid the unpleasantness of dealing with it. Because they want to avoid conflict and painful conversations, others have to hold 9's feet to the fire to address serious problems in relationships. Their desire to skirt conflict and fuse with another person is so strong that 9s will cling to relationships long past their expiration dates. 9s are not initiators, but they're thrilled when others reach out to them. They have a wonderful ability to reconnect with people whom they haven't run into in a long time. Even after years of not seeing a person, they can pick up the conversation as if it had only been yesterday when they last saw you. Here's what I've learned being married to a 9 and parenting a 9. What feels like a minor tiff to you feels like the battle of the bulge to them. What you hear as a fractional increase in the volume of your voice, a 9 hears as yelling. It's important that before I share my thoughts or feelings about something, I ask Annie or Maddie what theirs are. This not only honors them, it lessens the possibility they will merge with mine and perhaps agree to do something they don't want to do. 9s at work. Position available for even-keeled, reliable, enthusiastic team player to work in harmonious environment. Approachable and diplomatic, this person must be able to get along with a wide range of people. Those who enjoy stirring up controversies or playing office politics need not apply. If this want ad were to appear on LinkedIn, there would be a mile-long queue of 9s clamoring to get an interview. It might even occasion an outbreak of violence among this usually peaceful population. Healthy 9s are great workers and colleagues. Some have partners who believe in them and dedicate their lives to help them live into their potential, like Nancy Reagan or Hillary Clinton. Supportive, non-judgmental, and inclusive, they build bridges and bring people together in a spirit of cooperation. Many nines tell Suzanne and me they aren't particularly ambitious, though some are. They don't covet the corner office or need a big expense account. If they have a good job with reasonable pay and perks, they're content to stay where they are. Because they're able to see multiple points of view, nines can solve problems and put together deals where everyone wins. Nines draw their energy and derive a sense of identity from the group, so they would rather merge with the team and share the credit for a success than go out of their way to shine the spotlight on themselves to advance their career. They like a little recognition, but mostly fly under the radar so as not to draw too much attention to themselves. I mean, what if their accomplishments at work lead to a change in duties or being assigned more work? When an opportunity for advancement comes up, nines might pursue it, but only when they're ready. For the most part, nines aren't high-energy people, and they don't like feeling controlled or pressured to perform. Creatures of habit, nines appreciate structure, predictability, and routine in the workplace. Nines don't like to bring work home, and they definitely don't like interruptions on weekends or vacation. Nines make wonderful counselors, teachers, clergy, and public relations executives. Being a teacher is perfect for me, my wife Anne says. I work best when I know there's a set pattern and rhythm to my life. I like knowing which classes I teach on what days, when semesters begin and end, when vacations are, and what the head of school expects of me. And most of all, I have great relationships with my colleagues and I love the kids. Unfortunately, it's as easy to take advantage of nines in the workplace as it is in relationships. They're too accommodating. To avoid rocking the boat, they say yes when they want to say no and often regret it later. Nines tend to sell themselves short at work. They have considerable skills, but they undervalue them. Though capable of holding positions at the highest levels in the professional world, most nines gravitate toward middle management, where they can avoid the kind of conflicts and stress associated with leadership, you know, like making unpopular decisions, supervising employees, or having to fire people. Wings. Nines with an 8 wing. This is one of the most complex combinations on the Enneagram, given the 8's need to go against power and the 9's need to avoid conflict. 8's are energized by anger, while 9's avoid it at all costs. I mean, talk about a walking contradiction. These two numbers bring a new twist to the opposites attract cliché, but it is also a powerful place within the system. More energized, confident, stubborn, outgoing, and inner-directed than the 9 with 1 wings, 9 with 8 wings have more access to anger and express it more openly if they or others are threatened. Right now, I'm thinking of Suzanne's daughter, Jenny, who was a 9 with an 8 wing. She says to Suzanne all the time, "Mom, I'm in so much trouble. My 8 wing just did a bunch of stuff. It's going to take 3 weeks for my 9 wing to clean up." Remember, though, that this uptick in confidence and periodic aggression is relative to how other nines behave, not to other numbers who have way more access to their anger and can express it more openly. It's better to make peace than to have to make peace. Unknown. Though they will sometimes change their minds, nines with 8 wings find it much easier to be clear and direct about things that are important to them. Although the 8 wing doesn't make it more likely that they will act on their own behalf, they are energetic in acting on behalf of the underdog and the common good. These nines tend to be more confrontational than other nines, but they are also quick to be conciliatory. So now let's talk about nines with a one wing. Nines with a one wing, the perfectionist, have a strong sense of the difference between right and wrong. One energy helps these nines stay a little more focused, so they are able to accomplish more, which enhances their confidence. The nine with a one wing is more critical, orderly, introverted, and passive-aggressive than other nines. Because of their concern about matters of right and wrong, they're apt to be involved in peacemaking efforts or other social justice causes. These nines are principled and modest as leaders, and people want to follow them because of their integrity and steadfastness. Stress and security. In stress, nines start to act like unhealthy sixes, the loyalists. They become overcommitted, worried, rigid, wary of others, and anxious, even though they don't know why. These nines become more self-doubting, which makes decision-making even more difficult than usual. Interestingly, they also become reactive, a big departure for a number that is rarely, if ever, quick to react. Now, insecurity, when nines are feeling comfortable and safe in the world, they move to the positive side of three, the performer, where they are more goal-oriented, decisive, self-confident, and in touch with their life's agenda. Flourishing nines struggle less with inertia, take command of their lives, and believe their presence in the world matters. More importantly, nines connected to the positive side of three can experience and enjoy genuine peace and harmony. Spiritual transformation. The nine's weakness for merging is the dark side of an enviable spiritual gift. But in my mind, the spiritual advantages of being a nine more than make up for the work they have to do in their lives. If the goal of the spiritual life is the realization of union with God, then healthy nine's ability to merge gives them a spiritual leg up on the rest of us. When it comes to attaining a unitive knowledge of God and becoming one with Christ, healthy nines almost always cross the finish line first. They're natural contemplatives. Nines are open and receptive in every way. Even as kids, they seem to possess an innate awareness of the sacramental dimension of the world. They have a profound awareness of the interconnectedness of all things in creation. Lovers of the outdoors, they pick up on the presence of God in the natural world and how everything expresses God's glory. Because they value being over doing, nines know how to rest in God's love and share themselves more generously than the rest of us, frankly. And because nines are able to see both sides to everything, they're comfortable with paradox and mystery, which comes in handy when it comes to dealing with a religion that includes a virgin birth and a God who is both three and one at the same time. If you're a nine, listen to me. Be encouraged. When healthy, your capacity for merging can place you in the same league as other great nine spiritual leaders like Pope Francis and the Dalai Lama. But nines resist the unsafe nature of real spiritual transformation. If you're a peacemaker, your greatest motivation in life has been to avoid conflict and experience inner harmony. But what looks like peace is really just your desire to be unaffected by life. Spiritually, the absence of conflict is not the presence of peace, which requires work and risk. If nothing else, nines should hear these words. Wake up and say yes to the adventure of your own life. Nines are as important and as deserving of becoming their own person as everybody else is. It's their birthright. Waking up will involve reclaiming personal authority and responsibility for their life. It will mean finding and resurrecting their own thoughts, passions, opinions, dreams, ambitions, and desires. This is going to be scary. They'll have to stop hiding and drafting behind other people. If nines love themselves as much as they love other people, they will allow themselves to go on this adventure of becoming their own person. Paradoxically, the road to peace and harmony is littered with conflict and disharmony. Scrupulously avoid anything that promises a life of peace and tranquility without conflict or pain. Whatever it is will probably end you up in rehab. Nines don't like to admit it, but they're angry. I get it. I'd be angry too if I repeatedly felt overlooked. They're angry for the sacrifices they've made to keep the peace and hold relationships together. But when they get the urge to stand up for themselves or act on their own behalf, they don't do it. Nines are afraid if they let their stored anger out, it's going to hurt or kill someone. But that's not true. It might lead to conflict, which you can survive, but not homicide. Nines need to know that when they discover right action and move toward it, a feeling of self-worth will emerge in them, and others will notice and cheer them on as well. When this happens, they can stand and build on it so they don't have to slip away from themselves ever again. The healing message nines need to hear is, we see you, and your life matters. God didn't invite you to this party to live someone else's life. We need you here. 10 Paths to Transformation for Nines. 1. Journal on the question, what is my calling or life's program? Am I pursuing it or postponing it to keep the peace? 2. Ask someone to help you find a task management or to-do system to help you stay on task. There are lots of great apps out there just for this purpose. 3. Practice saying no when someone asks you to do something you don't want to. 4. Be aware of the numbing strategies you use to avoid having to deal with life, whether that's a glass of wine or shopping or Girl Scout cookies. 5. Don't be afraid to have opinions and express them. You can start with small things and build up to important ones. 6. Resist the urge to fall back on passive-aggressive behaviors like procrastination and avoidance. If you feel angry, be honest and open. 7. Understand how important and unique your voice is. People deserve to hear what you think, not have their own views mirrored back to them. 8. Remember that what feels like intense, terrible conflict to you might just be a typical disagreement for someone else. Take a breath and engage. 9. Realize that your tendency to merge with others can be a beautiful gift if directed toward God. Other types envy this spiritual advantage you have. But don't fuse with another person and miss out on the chance to become your own person. And finally, 10. When you feel paralyzed in the face of a decision, consult someone who won't tell you what to do, but rather will help you tease out what you want to do. And then do it. Chapter 5. Type 1. The Perfectionist. Perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor, the enemy of the people. Author Anne Lamott. Here are some statements a one might use to describe themselves. 1. People have told me I can be overly critical and judgmental. 2. I beat myself up when I make mistakes. 3. I don't feel comfortable when I try to relax. There's too much to be done. 4. I don't like it when people ignore or break the rules, like when the person in the fast lane at the grocery store has more items than allowed. 5. Details are really important to me. 6. I often find that I'm comparing myself to others. 7. If I say I'll do it, I'll do it. 8. It's hard for me to let go of resentment. 9. I think it's my responsibility to leave the world better than I found it. 10. I have a lot of self-discipline. 11. I try to be careful and thoughtful about how I spend money. 12. It seems to me that things are either right or wrong. 13. I spend a lot of time thinking about how I could be a better person. 14. Forgiveness is hard for me. 15. I notice immediately when things are wrong or out of place. 16. I worry a lot. 17. I am really disappointed when other people don't do their part. 18. I like routine and don't readily embrace change. 19. I do my best when working on a project, and I wish others would do the same so I wouldn't have to redo their work. 20. I often feel like I try harder than others to do things correctly. So here's what ones look like when they're healthy. They're committed to a life of service and integrity. They're balanced and responsible and able to forgive themselves and others for being imperfect. They're principled but patient with the processes that slowly but surely make the world a better place. Now, ones, when they're in that average space, they have judging and comparing minds that naturally spot errors and imperfections. They struggle to accept that imperfection is inevitable while fearing the tyranny of that critical voice in their head. And unhealthy ones? Man, they fixate on small imperfections. These ones are obsessed with micromanaging what they can. Asserting control over something or someone is their only relief. When the teacher turned off the lights and turned on the projector, I yawned, folded my arms to form a pillow on my desktop, and lay the side of my face down. As a seventh grader, I had no idea how Gregory Peck's depiction of Atticus Finch, a widowed father and attorney tasked with defending a falsely accused black man in a small southern town in the 1930s, would silently plant a seed in my heart. In To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch wears a sensible, perfectly pressed seersucker suit with a pocket watch attached to a chain that he keeps in his vest pocket. He is the exemplar of a wise, measured, and attentive father who treats his children with kindness and respect. He's an idealist, a reformer who feels a sacred duty to uphold the law and to make the world a more decent place for everyone. Imbued with a clear sense of right and wrong, he cannot turn a blind eye to injustice, and he isn't afraid to take a stand even if it costs him. When his daughter Scout asks why he would bother defending his client, Tom Robinson, in a case he has no chance of winning and for which townspeople will revile him, Atticus tells her, "Before I can live with other folks, I've got to live with myself. The one thing that doesn't abide by majority rule is a person's conscience." Despite Atticus's brilliant and impassioned closing argument, Tom Robinson is found guilty by an all-white jury, and led away. Downcast, Atticus packs up his briefcase and then slowly begins making his way down the aisle to exit the courtroom. As he does, those seated in the so-called colored balcony stand one by one in a gesture of respect for him. When the elderly Reverend Sykes looks down and realizes Scout has neither noticed nor understood the symbolic gravity of the black community's getting to their feet to honor her father, he whispers down to her, "Miss Jean Louise, Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing." That scene pierced me. Atticus Finch represented everything I wanted in a father, but knew I'd never have as the son of a deeply troubled alcoholic. With him, life was routine. Without him, life was unbearable, Scout said about her father. I would have said the reverse about mine. 20 years later, after my son was born, I came across an antique pocket watch that stirred my memory of Atticus Finch. I bought it, hoping that, when I looked at it, it would remind me of the kind of father I wanted to be. That's the effect that ones like Atticus can have on people. Sometimes their example inspires others to be better, to fight injustice, to embrace high ideals. But the one's commitment to living an exemplary life can quickly degenerate into a rigid perfectionism that can be torturous both for ones and for others. The one's deadly sin. Ones walk a thin line. When they're healthy, like Atticus, they inspire us with their concern for fairness and their desire to restore the world to wholeness. But when they tip toward average or unhealthy, they can quickly get in their own way. From the time they get up to the time they lie down, ones perceive a world rife with errors and feel a bounden duty to correct it. There's no shortage of work to be done. Someone squeezed the toothpaste tube from the middle. The school secretary misspelled two words in the PTA newsletter. One of the kids didn't fold and hang their bath towel correctly. There's a fresh scratch on the car door, and the neighbors left for work, leaving their trash cans at the foot of the driveway without the lids on. What kind of person does that sort of thing? Ones need to be perfect. They chase perfection because they have this vague, unsettling feeling that if they make a mistake, someone is going to jump out to blame, criticize, or punish them. They compulsively strive to fix all that's broken in the world, but the work's never finished. Irritated doesn't begin to capture how this makes ones feel at times. That others appear less concerned and interested in joining their crusade to put this world aright infuriates them even more. Why don't people care as much as I do? Do I have to do everything myself? It's not fair. Anger is the deadly sin of ones, but resentment is truer to their experience. You see, ones believe the world judges people who don't follow the rules, control their emotions, behave appropriately, and keep their basic animal instincts in check. For ones, anger tops the list of feelings that, quote-unquote, good people shouldn't express. So they bury the anger they feel about the imperfections they see in the environment, in others, and in themselves. Ones are among the three numbers in the anger triad. Remember those? 8, 9, and 1. Unlike 8s, who externalize their anger, or 9s, who fall asleep to it, ones stuff their anger until it sits right below the surface, where it expresses itself to everyone as smoldering resentment. But something else is fueling one's anger and indignation. Everywhere they look, people are having a grand old time indulging their desires or breaking the rules and not getting caught and punished for it, while ones, on the other hand, feel obligated to forego doing what they want to do in order to do what they should do, namely, order our disordered world. To add insult to injury, they not only end up doing their share, but they have to pick up the slack for all the jerks down at the beach drinking beer and playing volleyball when they have fun things they'd like to do as well. Several years ago on Saturday Night Live, Dana Carvey played a character named Enid Strict, otherwise known as the Church Lady, who hosts a talk show called Church Chat. It's an over-the-top but iconic portrayal of a one personality when it's in full bloom. If they're not careful, average ones can adopt a similar Puritan-like attitude toward the world, or, as Mark Twain put it, become good in the worst sense of the word. All about ones or perfectionists. Walter is a tax attorney with a prestigious Wall Street accounting firm. When he comes home from work, he likes the house to be clean, the kids to be bathed, dinner to be on the table, and the world to be rightly ordered. I doubt Walter has ever come right out and told his wife Alice that these are his expectations, but it's not hard to pick it up in the air when Walter's around. One night, Walter comes home from work and the house is clean, the kids are bathed, and the dinner is on the table. Now, you'd think Walter would put his briefcase down and say something nice like, "Wow, this is awesome." But the first thing Walter does is point at the couch and say, "Those cushions are out of place." Now, if I came home and said that to my wife Anne, she'd say, "Oh, really? Well, let me show you where I can place those cushions." In defense of ones, that's just how they see. Wherever they go, errors and mistakes jump out at them and yell, "Fix me!" And they just can't leave it alone. They'll either say something or rearrange the cushions when you're not looking. What's important for us to learn as we study the Enneagram is that we can't change the way we see, only what we do with what we see. Walter has done a lot of work on himself since that unfortunate episode with Alice. If he did something like that today, he'd immediately apologize. "I've got to keep working on that," he'd say, laughing. God bless Walter. The Enneagram has helped him come a long way. Ones have high expectations of others and themselves. For average ones, controlling their behavior and emotions is a priority. When a quote-unquote uncivilized impulse or unacceptable feeling arises, ones will automatically push it down and bring up its opposite to negate it. In psychology, this defense is called reaction formation. An example might be ones who, when they hear your singing voice, will unconsciously stop their envy from rising to the level of conscious awareness and replace it with enthusiastic praise. Now, at one level, I mean, this is admirable. But because it's motivated by a self-interested need to not feel bad, the one's thin-lipped smile and kind words can feel forced. Ones running on cruise control are mercilessly hard on themselves. Some demand perfection be maintained in only one corner of their lives, like the yard, their boat, their office, while others apply it across the board. The house has to be immaculate, the bills paid on time, thank you notes need to be written and posted the same day gifts are received. Ones have to keep hard copies of tax returns for 5 years to avoid being in violation of IRS rules. And let's not even discuss the agony a poor one endures when they discover their credit score has dipped below 800. Unfortunately, they also impose their high standards to others. Every Monday, I would send our poor minister an email with a list of quote-unquote suggestions to help her improve on what I didn't think worked at the previous morning's worship service, a now self-aware one shared at one of our Enneagram workshops. I would recommend better ways she could lead worship songs, tighten up her sermon, or shorten the communion lines. And I always ended with a reminder to begin the service at precisely 10 a.m. unless she wanted people to continue arriving late. Thankfully, things are different now. My wife says she's proud of how I'm working toward being less helpful, he said, laughing. If you suspect someone's a one, but you're not sure, watch how they react when they open a dishwasher someone else has loaded. If they cluck their tongue and start reloading it while muttering something like, "Good night, why can't people do this correctly?" then there's a better than 50-50 chance they're a one. Sometimes a one won't even let you finish stacking the dishwasher before they jump in to help. They'll lean on the counter while you're loading it and say, "Eh-eh," when you place a mug where they think a bowl should go. Most people can't endure being judged and harassed for too long by someone who has pinned a star to their shirt and elected themselves the kitchen sheriff. Eventually, the harangued throw their hands in the air and storm out of the kitchen saying, "Is nothing ever good enough for you?" I get it. As far as I'm concerned, if all the dishes fit and a little water hits most of them, who cares if they're perfectly arranged? What most people don't understand is that ones don't think they're being critical. In their mind, they're trying to help you. They think they're improving you. And doesn't everyone want to improve themselves like they do? Not all ones are fixated on flaws in the environment. Some ones I know couldn't care less whether their house is a mess or when they see someone not picking up after their dog. Their need to be good and improve things expresses itself through their concern and commitment to addressing social ills. The activist and legendary consumer protector Ralph Nader is a one. You don't want to mess with that dude or any person who was a one on the Enneagram who gets involved with efforts to put an end to wrongs like sex trafficking, corrupt politicians, or companies polluting the environment. One of the reasons ones are attracted to supporting righteous causes is because it's not only okay, but it's appropriate to openly express anger about injustice without feeling like you're being a bad girl or boy. Because they believe they occupy the superior moral, ethical, and spiritual high ground, ones believe their way is the only right way of seeing and doing things, and therefore feel justified in being judgmental and critical of others. They're usually not trying to come off that way, though. People tell me my voice and body language come off as shaming and judgmental, even when I'm consciously trying to sound kind, my friend Janet says. That the one's talk style is preaching doesn't help. No one likes to feel like someone is talking down to them. All of us have a reproachful voice that gets triggered from time to time when we do something stupid, and then it goes away. As a rule, ones have a merciless inner critic. Unlike ours, it never goes away. It's punishing. It's relentless. It says stuff like, "Why do you always put your foot in your mouth? What kind of parent forgets to pack his kid's lunch in her school bag? How do you expect to make a sale when you can't even tie a proper knot in your tie? Get down and give me 50! Heck, sometimes a one's inner critic will blame them for screwing up things they weren't even involved with or responsible for. After years of programming, it's hard for ones to shut off that cruel voice. Ones caught in the trance of their personality believe not only that their belittling inner critic speaks ex cathedra, but that it actually has their best interests at heart. They think to themselves, How would I have progressed this far in life without that voice harshly reminding me of what I was doing wrong or to prevent me from lowering my standards? If it weren't for my inner critic always pointing out my deficiencies, how would I know how to live beyond reproach? Think of how many more mistakes I would have made without it. Ones are terrified of making a mistake. Ones work themselves way too hard. And because there's so much to get done, they don't often relax or let themselves have fun. As a result, they become pressure cookers whose regulator valves can't keep up with the buildup of resentment they feel toward the imperfections they see everywhere, the resentment they harbor toward themselves and others for failing to adhere to their high standards and for not helping out, and their outsized fear of making mistakes or acting inappropriately. It's quite a surprise when a normally very controlled and tightly buttoned up one blows a valve. And when it happens, trust me, someone almost always gets burned. No matter how you look at it, the one's crusade to perfect the world is a fool's errand. There's always an unmade bed in it somewhere. Until they begin a spiritual journey, they'll never know a minute's peace. Given the stream of negative self-commentary their inner critic levels at them all day, ones don't receive criticism well. I mean, would you express gratitude to a fellow writer who pointed out your failure to insert a comma after an introductory phrase if the finger-wagging carper living in your head had already been comparing your grammar to fetid effluvium from the moment you started work at 3 a.m.? Please, please, people, one mugging at a time. Though very sensitive to criticism themselves, ones are shocked when you tell them you feel like they're being harshly critical of you. Seriously? You're only being given a thimble-sized sample of the bitter self-recrimination they drink from every day. Ones can be critical and judgmental of other people. The unaware one will criticize people for failing to live up to their standard of perfection, and also because misery loves company. It brings ones a sense of relief if they can catch and criticize someone else for doing something incorrectly or behaving improperly because it levels the playing field. Thank goodness, they say, someone besides me is deficient. Of course, you know, taking pleasure in someone else's shortcomings is a kind of kooky way to, you know, tie the score, but it beats feeling like you're the only one who ever makes mistakes on the field. What is this self inside us? This silent observer, severe and speechless critic who can terrorize us. Poet T.S. Eliot. So those are some of the challenges that come with ones. But can you imagine a world without them? If it weren't for Steve Jobs' uncompromising passion for creating flawlessly designed products, there'd be no Apple. If it weren't for high-minded leaders like Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela, who couldn't abide injustice, then India and South Africa might still be under the oppressive yoke of European colonialism. If it weren't for spiritual teachers like Richard Rohr, we wouldn't have as clear a picture of the loving heart of God. Not to mention ones like Hillary Clinton and Jerry Seinfeld. Since ones live in a world riddled with mistakes, they keep a running list of things that need doing. Some are so thoughtful and generous that they make lists of things for you to do as well. Come Saturday morning, the spouse of a one can expect to find a honey-do list on the kitchen counter long enough to keep them busy for an entire summer and into deer hunting season. Many ones value etiquette. For example, Martha Stewart is a one. And they know how to host a great dinner party. Their homes are normally spotless and thoughtfully decorated. Because they want you to have a perfect time, they'll cook a beautiful meal and they'll be prepared to introduce great topics for table conversation. Recently, someone told me that while sitting vigil at his mother's deathbed, she repeatedly asked him if the house was tidy and if he was using the good china to serve coffee to the family members who were gathered downstairs awaiting news of her passing. I mean, talk about a good host. Ones want to be good people. They always want to do the right thing. How would you react if you were sitting in a bus station when a mentally ill person walked in and announced, "I'm homeless. I haven't eaten for days and I need help"? Regardless of what anyone else would do or what they themselves would want to do, ones would believe it was their responsibility to make sure the person received proper care. Why? Because that's the correct, responsible, and right thing to do. And you know what? We should all expect this of ourselves. Ones believe that every task should be done in a systematic and correct fashion. Like when they read the directions to assemble a recently purchased grill, and those directions say not to do anything until you make sure you have all the necessary parts, ones actually set out all the screws, nuts, and bolts and count them. Then they double check. Now, if by chance one of the four plastic cups that fit on the end of each leg is missing, ones will say to their spouse, "We can't put this thing together tonight. We're short one piece." Now, if the spouse is a 9, he or she might say, "Oh, don't worry about it. We can get a pack of matches and put it under that leg to keep the grill level." True ones will respond firmly, "Not on my watch," and then will call the 800 number to ask for the missing black cap to be shipped as soon as possible, so every step will have been followed correctly. The reason ones won't settle for a jerry-rigged grill is they know that every time they look at it, the only thing they'll see is that one missing black leg cap. By the way, ones break out in hives at our house. We've got packs of matches keeping the place level. I mean, like, under the foundation. Ones as children. Growing up, ones try to be model kids. They know the rules and follow them to the letter. They spend lots of energy comparing themselves to other kids, so a conversation during the ride home from school will include a little bit about themselves, but it will mostly be about comparing themselves to other children and their successes, failures, and mishaps. Like, think of 11-year-old Hermione Granger getting on the train to Hogwarts and immediately comparing notes about what spells the other kids could do and whether they had read Hogwarts, a history. This comparing and judging mind remains with ones their entire life. That inner critic makes its presence known early, so ones are hard on themselves. They sometimes shy away from sports or other group activities where they may not excel, since perfection is the goal at a very early age. They ask lots of questions about whether they're doing things right, and they take responsibility for things that aren't even their fault. It's hard for kids to figure out right from wrong, but these kids sure try. While ones aren't great multitaskers, I mean, it's hard to do more than one thing perfectly at a time, right? They don't usually mind when they are asked to pick up toys, straighten their bed, or tie their shoes. Neatness and order are comforting to ones, even when they're small. It makes them feel safe and less anxious. Hey, have you seen or read Marie Kondo's book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up? Whoa! Starting when the professional organizer was 5 years old, she would browse longingly through magazines showing perfect meals and lovely interior design. So she started reorganizing her family's belongings at home and the teacher's things at school, skipping recess in order to rearrange the bookshelves in her classroom. All the while, she would complain about the school's poor storage methods. If only there was an S-hook. It would be so much easier to use, she would sigh. Now listen, I'll bet you dinner at my favorite rib house in Nashville that Marie Kondo is a one. You know, it's hard being a perfectionist. So hard, in fact, that someone wrote and published a children's book titled Nobody's Perfect, a story for children about perfectionism, to help these little people before their inner critic permanently sets up shop in their heads. The wounding message little ones on the Enneagram pick up is that they have to be good and do things right. Mistakes are unacceptable. People and things are either perfect or wrong. Period. One, kids need to be told that making mistakes is normal, that they can be imperfect and loved at the same time. They can develop into the healthy side of one more naturally if they're given the healing message that mistakes are just part of the process of learning and growing up. So look, if you're parenting a one, make sure you correct them when no one else is around so as not to shame them in front of others. These kids may seem confident all the time, but they're more thin-skinned than you might think. Have no fear of perfection. You'll never reach it. Artist Salvador Dali. Ones in relationships. To form intimate relationships or deep friendships, ones first have to overcome the difficulty they have making themselves vulnerable to others. Author Brené Brown calls perfectionism a 20-ton shield. We use it to defend ourselves against being hurt. Unfortunately, what perfectionism really does is defend us against connecting with others. For ones, putting down the shield will require relinquishing their need to keep their emotions tightly buttoned up all the time. They'll also need to acknowledge their fear of making mistakes, their sensitivity to criticism, and their concern about saying or doing the wrong things. It takes a lot of courage for ones to be this transparent, but they can do it. I once heard Helen Palmer say something to the effect that ones don't throw a lot of hugs around or gush, "I love you," every 5 minutes, but that doesn't mean they don't. Ones say "I love you" by being responsible and doing what's expected of them to make the world a better, more secure place for you. They will make sure you always get your annual physical. They'll make life work on a budget. And every meal they cook for you will be the right portion size and contain the right combination of proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. What? You wanted more hugs as a kid? Well, remember how after that hurricane, yours was the only house in the neighborhood with power and heat? Because years earlier, your dad, who's a one on the Enneagram, bought a backup generator and regularly checked to make sure it was properly serviced and fueled? Sounds like a hug to me. Ones at work. No one cares about details more than ones. So there are certain career paths we want them to pursue. I flew from Los Angeles to Sydney, Australia last year on an Airbus A380, the largest plane in the world. Now, I'm usually not a nervous flyer, but I'm telling you, the size of this plane spooked me. How could something so huge possibly get off the ground, let alone stay in the air for 16 hours? Prior to departure, the co-captain took a stroll through the cabin, welcoming passengers aboard, and he happened to notice I had a book about the Enneagram on my lap. "My wife's into the Enneagram," he said, pointing at the book. "She says I'm a one, whatever that means." "It means I have nothing to be nervous about," I said, breathing a sigh of relief. Because they believe that tasks should be carried out methodically and that it's important to follow procedures and protocols, you not only want ones to pilot your plane, you also want them to be the engineer who designs the brake system on your car, the pharmacist who fills your prescriptions, the programmer writing the code for your company's new website, the architect drawing up plans for your dream house, the accountant preparing your taxes, and the editor combing through your latest book. And though I pray you never need one, you for sure want your cardiologist or neurosurgeon to be a one as well. Ones make top-notch lawyers, judges, politicians, military personnel, law enforcement officers, and, of course, teachers. Industrious, reliable, and well-organized, ones thrive in structured environments where they know what the deadlines are and who is responsible for what tasks. Because they're afraid of making mistakes, ones need regular feedback and encouragement. They so appreciate clear guidelines that they might take the 800-page HR manual home on the first day at their new job and read it from cover to cover. They won't argue when they're docked a day's wages for showing up late to a job site, so long as everyone else who showed up late receives the same penalty. Now, ones are great at sizing up what's not working inside a company or organization and devising new systems and procedures to get it running right again. A major state university hired a friend of mine, who happens to be a one on the Enneagram, to overhaul its health and benefits department. In 3 years, she transformed it from the most poorly run office on campus into a department that was so efficient, other universities sent their benefits people to model their own departments after its example. But there can also be problems with ones in the workplace, like their tendency to procrastinate. It is not a good sign if you spy a one tapping the eraser end of a pencil on her knee while staring blankly into a dark computer screen. Though they're self-disciplined and driven to succeed, some ones can put off starting or completing a project for fear they won't do it perfectly. The occasional bout of procrastination, compounded by their hesitation to make quick decisions for fear of making a mistake, can slow things down for a whole team. This same fear of making mistakes will lead ones to check and recheck their work forever, so others might have to encourage them to let it go and move on to the next task. Ones typically have trouble adapting to change, resent being interrupted when working on a project, and globalize problems. They think if one part of the business is tanking, then the whole business is going under. If they discover a flaw in the business plan, they worry the whole plan is flawed and might need a major or complete overhaul. Because they're afraid of criticism or failure, ones will quickly disavow responsibility when something goes wrong. It's not unusual to hear a one say, "It wasn't my fault," or, "Don't blame me, I didn't do it." As leaders, ones work hard to support people who work for them, particularly those who demonstrate a real desire to improve. At times, however, ones can be controlling, a little rigid and stingy with praise even when it's deserved. They also can have difficulty delegating, because of concern that a task won't be done correctly unless they do it themselves. Some ones will annoy their coworkers no end by redoing all sorts of tasks they think others have failed to do right the first time. Ones who extend their barrage of self-criticism to their colleagues are not generally the most popular people at the water cooler. Finally, ones at work, just like ones in other areas of life, struggle with naming and owning their anger. If you work with a one, you need to know that when they start ranting with a disproportionate amount of angry energy about something, you know, like the jerk who took their parking space, that's probably not what they're angry about. Their anger is about a tiff they had with their spouse that morning that they've worked hard to stuff and not acknowledge all day, and now it's leaking out sideways. So if you listen, Gently ask clarifying questions and give them enough space. Ones will eventually be able to trace a line back to what it is that actually made them angry. They need a little help to figure out what's really going on with them. But here's one of the things I love about ones. When healthy, they are deeply committed to helping others become their absolute best. They no longer seek to perfect the other person, but to help them self-actualize without shaming or scolding. My friend, Melanie, she's an Episcopal priest and a mature one. She says, "In all the work I have done, I have always enjoyed every opportunity I have had to build people up by affirming their hard work and talents. This is one of the greatest gifts in my ministry," she says. "Jesus calls us to share in God's mission. Paul calls us to share in building up the church. As a minister, this invites me into the delight and joy of encouraging people to bring their best to God and to work with people to discern what gifts of the Spirit God has given him for the realization of the kingdom. I can't tell you how helpful it would have been if I'd had a spiritually well put together one like Melanie mentor me when I was a young man." That said, if you want someone who is efficient, ethical, meticulous, reliable, and does the work of two people, then hire a one. Wings. Ones with a two wing, they're more extroverted, warm, helpful, and empathetic on the high side of two, but they can be more critical and controlling on the low side of two. They are effective in problem solving for both individuals and groups. They are generous in their response to church, education, community, government, and family. Ones with a two wing